ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
We couldn't have done it without our wider community, our families and our children that have had our back day in and day out, every step of the way. Otherwise, yeah, I don't know where we would have been, basically.
It's hoped today's guilty plea will help the town of Forbes in central New South Wales move forward. 18 months after the murder of childcare worker Molly Ticehurst. We'll have more on that shortly. And thousands of tonnes of medical equipment that was headed for landfill has been diverted and is now saving the lives of animals.
I had a big koala that lost its temperature, so we were able to put it into the hemocrib and brought back that temperature back up. And then if I have young babies, like furless babies, I can put them in there and it keeps that temperature.
I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide. But firstly, one of the most controversial episodes for Australian art in recent years is now heading to the South Australian Supreme Court. The APY Arts Centre Collective, which represents more than 500 Aboriginal artists, is suing the publisher of Rupert Murdoch's The Australian newspaper for defamation over what's become known as the White Hands on Black Art affair. Joining me now is Port Pirie reporter George Yankovic, who's been following this story. George, why is The Australian being sued?
Well, beginning in 2023, the paper, which is, of course, owned by Nationwide News, part of the News Corp network, started publishing a series of stories by reporter Greg Berup, who now works for the Australian Financial Review, but is named as a co-defendant in this lawsuit. The stories were a culmination of a months-long investigation into the APY Arts Centre Collective, an internationally recognised body, one of the country's most well-known Aboriginal art groups, has had their works exhibited all across the country, internationally as well. The allegations focused on claims that non-Aboriginal gallery staff would routinely interfere with the production of artwork by Aboriginal artists in a way that some of those artists were not particularly pleased about. At the centre of all this, you had a 50-second clip taken at one of the studios, which was leaked to The Australian, and that clip showed a non-Aboriginal gallery assistant applying paint to a canvas by Yarichi Young, whose works retail for upward of $10,000 on the market, up as high as $30,000. And also discussing discussing creative choices with her, saying things like, "Can I juice this one up a bit?" in reference to some of the colour palettes on that canvas. Now, The Australian also said that it spoke to artists and former gallery staff who said that this was quite common practice and that some artists were not particularly happy about it. And The Australian's sources alleged that this was supposedly happening because the collective wanted to make the artwork it was exporting more palatable for a non-Aboriginal audience. And in fact, one of the claims in contention is that the general manager at the time had a rigid aesthetic that she wanted artists to adhere to. And of course, the truth of that will come out in court. At the same time, the centre came out, and as did many artists associated with the centre, came out very strong and said that they rejected the overarching narrative that was presented here, which was one of interference in sacred Aboriginal cultural practices. They also went to say that they were very transparent about the role that gallery assistants, or I should say professional art assistants, played in the production of artwork, but at no point was that done without the express direction of artists. So a couple of years later, and after several inquiries, which we'll speak about in a minute, The centre is suing the Australian's publisher for $4.4 million, saying that they've suffered significant financial and reputational loss, the loss of hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of government funding, a downturn in sales, and also the delay of a major exhibition of the APY Arts Centre Collective Artwork being held at the National Gallery of Australia, which is finally going ahead next year. But with the matter reaching the South Australian Supreme Court, it really will be a test of the fidelity and accuracy of the Australian's reporting.
So, George, what have the Australian and Greg Bearup said about their next steps here?
The Australian confirmed to us that they will defend the claim and that they stand by their reporting. They say that the investigation uncovered serious allegations of what they called white cultural theft, and also that making reference to an inquiry that was initiated jointly by the SA, NT and federal governments, in which Mr. Bearup claimed that sources close to the investigation, while the findings were never released, he claimed that sources close to it said that it uncovered substantial wrongdoing in every area that it was tasked to investigate. There wasn't any documentary evidence presented as such to corroborate those claims, but the Australian will take this to court and stand by the reporting. And we did try to contact Mr. Bearup as well for comments, but he has not responded as of yet.
You're on Australia Wide with me, Alex Hyman. I'm chatting to Port Pirie reporter George Yankovic about the White Hands on Black art affair. Now, George, this is now going to the Supreme Court, but what have those previous inquiries actually revealed about the claims that were aired in the Australian's coverage?
So the centre was the subject of four different inquiries over the last 2.5 years. The very first one was carried out pretty much as soon as the news broke by the National Gallery, which was obviously on the cusp of exhibiting these artworks that had their provenance put into question. So the National Gallery said that it spoke to the artists responsible for these 28 works, and none of them reported having been interfered with in the production of that artwork. And they said that the artwork satisfied their provenance standards for Aboriginal art. One of the interesting points that was made in that review, and it sort of branched out into a wider conversation within the Australian art world, is the extent to which gallery assistants should play a role in the production of art. And the review, in support of its findings, drew on artists as diverse as Michelangelo and Rembrandt, for example, saying that artists do regularly instruct their assistants about how to or ask for their help in applying paint, in doing underpaint, for example, which is what was depicted in that video that the Australian aired, and that it was not out of the norm. Now, if we move on a little bit further, that review that I mentioned earlier from the state, SA, Northern Territory and federal governments, that was carried out by Indigenous cultural experts and a lawyer as well, who interviewed more than 200 people. And while the findings have never been made public, they did refer those findings onto the Office of the Registrar of Indigenous Corporations and the ACCC. ORIC said that it would not take any further action and that no adverse inference should be drawn from that. And the ACCC also ruled out any breaches of consumer law, noting that in the past it has come down on art dealers purporting to sell art authentically Aboriginal artwork that may have been made elsewhere, either by non-Aboriginal people or on a factory line. But now, obviously, that it's gone to court, the veracity and the accuracy behind some of these claims that have been made about that state and federal government review will also be called into question, and what exactly was uncovered during that exhaustive process.
So then, George, how are the artists at the centre feeling about what's happened over the past 2 years?
Well, we spoke a couple of weeks ago to Sandra Pumani, who is the collective's board chair as well as an artist in her own right. This is before news of the lawsuit broke, but we did ask her a little bit about how she was feeling about everything that's unfolded over the past 2 years, and particularly how she's feeling about the Neuropolka exhibition, that major exhibition at the National Gallery, finally opening next year. And here's a bit of what she had to say to us.
I am thinking now what we went through. It was, you know, really hurtful thing that happened to us. And I'm thinking, you know, having this, it will, you know, heal our hearts because of what happened. And we've lost so many of our people, you know, having all this grief and everything and going ahead and having this. We're all looking forward on this. And I think it's going to heal lots of people's hearts. So we want to put aside and, you know, looking forward on this and want to continue on, you know, there's none of our elders left anymore. And, you know, it's for us to stand up and, you know, move forward and take it on.
Sandra Pomani there from the APY Arts Centre Collective talking about the opening of that major exhibition next year at the National Gallery of Australia. Now, the Australian has said that it will defend the claim, but it hasn't offered a response yet to that statement of claim that's been lodged with the Supreme Court. And there's no indication yet when the matter will return to court, but we will be following the story as it develops.
Our reporter in Port Pirie is George Yankovic. George, thanks so much for bringing us up to date here on Australia Wide.
Thank you, Alex.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
The man accused of killing childcare worker Molly Ticehurst in Forbes, New South Wales, has pleaded guilty to her murder. The Ticehurst family has thanked their community, many of whom stood outside the Forbes local court today. The case sparked community action and major changes to bail laws in New South Wales, as Tim Fuchs reports.
The former partner of Forbes mother Molly Ticehurst has pleaded guilty to murdering her at her Central West New South Wales home. Daniel Billings faced multiple charges over the death of the 28-year-old in April 2024. He pleaded guilty to murder and admitted guilt to numerous other charges, including breaching an AVO. Outside court, Molly's father, Tony Ticehurst, paid tribute to his daughter, as well as the people of Forbes.
Today is a special day, and I really appreciate the support from the people of Forbes and surrounds and all my friends and everywhere. And I'd like to thank you very much.
Molly's death rocked her local community and galvanised campaigners to push for reform around domestic violence offences. In June 2024, the New South Wales government made it mandatory for electronic monitoring devices to be worn by people who were on bail for such charges. Bail laws were also tightened up, as Premier Chris Minns explained at the time.
We will introduce legislation reversing the presumption of bail for serious domestic violence offences in the state.
The guilty plea comes 18 months after Molly was killed. She was a childcare worker at the Learning Ladder in Forbes, with Director of the Centre Jodie Jukes describing the last year and a half as a tough and long wait for the community.
It has been a big weight on everybody's shoulders to move forward with the loss of Molly for our wider community. I just hope now moving forward to a quicker process for the family and the community.
She too thanked the Forbes community for their support after Molly's death.
We couldn't have done it without our wider community, our families and our children that have had our back day in and day out, every step of the way. Otherwise, yeah, I don't know where we would have been, basically.
The next step is an arraignment hearing at the New South Wales Supreme Court in Sydney on the 12th of December.
Tim Fuchs reporting there. And if this story has raised any issues for you or someone you know, there is help available. You can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline on 1-800-RESPECT. That's the National Domestic Violence Helpline on 1-800-RESPECT.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
And you are with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company here on Australia Wide. Remember, you can podcast the show or listen back to the program through the ABC Listen app. It's what we recommend. Or you can also visit the Australia Wide website. Just search for ABC Australia Wide. And, of course, you can always email us. We love to hear what's happening in your part of the world. You can get in touch by emailing australiawide.radio@abc.net.au. That's australiawide.radio@abc.net.au. A WA cattle producer ordered to cull more than 100 feral donkeys on his property says he won't shoot them himself, but he won't stand in the way of bullets. Chris Hengeler from Kachana Station believes the animals have played a key role in regenerating his land. But the four-year legal battle with the government over the donkeys came to an end last week. Jess Baker has the story.
Feral donkeys are declared agriculture pests in Western Australia for the negative impact they have on the environment. Their hard hooves are known to cause erosion and damage vegetation. But for years, pastoralist Chris Hengeler has believed donkeys can be valuable tools of land management. He lives on the remote Kachana Station in the heart of the Kimberley and keeps a herd of about 120 feral donkeys.
Yeah, so we've got more vegetation, we've got more grass, and we've got more animals, and they're all happy in that area. And the area where we settled, which was the worst country, is now comparable to a dairy farm over east.
WA's Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development ordered the donkeys on Kachana be culled 4 years ago in 2021. Kachana Pastoral Company has been fighting to keep the donkeys alive since. The stoush came to an end last week when the State Administrative Tribunal decided to back DPIRD's donkey cull order.
I'm not going to shoot animals that I've that have actually helped me get the results I'm getting. If other people want to do that, say, I'm not going to fight, I'm not going to start dodging bullets or standing in the way of bullets, but I don't believe it's a good idea to be replacing herbivores with fire, and I'm not going to be doing it.
The group that would likely oversee the culling is called the Kimberley Rangelands Biosecurity Association. KRBA estimates it has managed or killed around 600,000 donkeys in the Kimberley since 1978. Executive Officer of the group, Dick Passfield, says he's relieved the legal battle is finally over and he supports the tribunal's decision to order the culling of donkeys at Kachana Station.
We believe that this really sends out a message that both the department and the government are serious about biosecurity issues, but not only in the southwest, but right across the state in these, the remote locations like the Kimberley. And it also shows they're not afraid to deal with issues that will inherently have puts the department at odds with some sections of the community. But I guess, honestly, we don't really take too much joy in it because the Kimberley is a big place, as you well know, and the community, as you also know, is very small. And in the pastoral industry, most people know each other. So, it's this sort of thing can really put pressure on those relationships and the social fabric.
For a long time, the biosecurity group has had concerns about the Wild Donkey Project.
When we first heard about the project, we had a number of concerns about it, both operational and design aspects of it. And despite, the many positive things that you could find online about the project, there was actually no formal or scientific research ever carried out over its lifetime. And if you've got no data collected, how are you going to convince the sceptics when you have nothing like that in your toolbox?
The lack of scientific evidence is an issue that was also raised during the legal battle, and it was found Kachana's case contained a lot of anecdotal opinion and a small amount of specific data. The tribunal suggested it might be worthwhile all of the parties, DPIRD, KRBA and Kachana, work together to explore the potential benefits of feral donkeys. Mr. Hengeler says Kachana would need support to conduct formal research studies.
By all means, we're happy to run experiments. We're just a small private outfit, a family-run company, and we manage things on a shoestring. We can't afford to do all the science. We're happy to provide the results and let people come and analyse what we've done.
Now the legal battle has ended, Mr. Hengeler says the future of Kachana is uncertain, but there's a chance tourists could one day see the land that's captured attention around the world.
We're at a crossroads. It's either the takeaway, we lose our main rangeland management tool, which is the donkeys, which can deal with the stuff in the hills, and then we just have to replace them with fire, like everybody else has, which we can't explore the full productive pastoral productive capacity of Kachana, but we can apply for a tourist license and have tourists.
Chris Hengeler of Kachana Station, ending that report by Jess Baker. You also heard from Dick Passfield, Executive Officer of the Kimberley Rangelands Biosecurity Association, and a Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development spokesperson said the department would liaise with the station operations in relation to the requirements of the pest control notice. And for more on this story, you can head to abc.net.au and search donkeys.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
It's a species that I have been fighting for.
Growing up in the bush is such a special thing.
So when the rain does come, we've got a few numbers.
What if it never comes?
Put a feather in your cap.
ABC Radio.
To South Australia now. An army veteran walking around Australia to raise money for charity has had the police called on him in a South Australian country pub because of his assistance dog. Despite assistance dog Max wearing a vest and being accredited, Garth Murray says they still faced illegal discrimination. But the problems faced by those with an assistance animal is more complicated than just an unwelcoming publican. Arj Gunnison has this report.
Going to the pub and booking a room, it should be relatively simple. But for people who need an assistance dog, it can be a battle. While on their walk around Australia for charity, Garth Murray, an army veteran who spent 15 years in the service, stopped for the night at a country SA pub. But that turned into a call to the cops.
The owner, he said that I could have Max in there until anyone else arrived. And then I said, oh, he's a qualified assistance dog, so he's allowed to be in here even when there are other people here. And he wasn't happy with that.
Since setting out in 2024 from Queensland, Mr. Murray said he had encountered a few problems, but sometimes used tactics to counter covert discrimination. He often leaves his accredited assistance dog, Max, outside while he secures accommodation to ensure businesses did not falsely claim to have no free rooms or try to put them in a lesser room. After booking a room and dropping his belongings, Mr. Murray said he went down to the front bar with Max for a beer.
And he said that I'll let you stay in here, but if you want to eat dinner, then you'll have to have it at the side of the bar. And I said, oh, well, legally we're allowed to be in the dining room because he's qualified assistance dog. He wasn't happy with that, and that he wanted me to leave. And I said, well, legally, like at the law, that we're allowed to be in here. I'd already asked for beer, and he poured that beer out. I hadn't paid for it yet. And he said that he wasn't going to service and he was going to call the police.
When police arrived, they reviewed Mr. Murray's accreditation paperwork and told the owners he and Max were allowed to be there.
I was able to order a beer finally. I try to educate people at different places I go to, and I tell them you're quite within your right to ask to see the ID, because some people do buy fake assistance dog vests or jackets online, and they give real assistance dogs a bad name because they're usually nowhere near as well trained.
Under the Disability Discrimination Act, it is illegal to deny public access to anyone with an accredited assistance dog. However, with no national accreditation body or standard, each state is left to decide what organisations can provide that accreditation. It's also up to each state or territory to decide what interstate organisations it will recognise. To make it even murkier, a federal government spokesperson said an assistance animal that did not hold state or territory accreditation might still be protected under the DDA. With the rules unclear, the Australian Hotels Association says providing consistent education and training is difficult. Those on the door are left to make decisions on balance between safe work and hygiene standards and disability discrimination laws. This inconsistency has led to National Peak Body Assistance Dog Australia's Tim Taylor to call on the federal government to take the lead for a national framework and accreditation scheme.
The challenge with the legislation is that it's very broad. It doesn't talk to any sort of training standards and doesn't talk to actually identifying exactly what an assistance dog is. Flip side of this problem is that a lot of the public are confused and having to navigate the challenges themselves of trying to work through, you know, whether a dog is accredited or not. This environment you're talking to, it's multifaceted. It's a complex problem.
A national standard would also combat issues of substandard training and people who buy an assistance dog vest online.
There's an animal welfare aspect to this. If you put a dog in an environment where it's not comfortable, it's not the right thing for the dog. So that's one area. I think the second thing it does is it actually is a potential public risk. I think the third part of it is they when, you know, you can see when a dog isn't actually behaving in public, and if that dog has a jacket on that says it's an assistance dog, then, you know, I think that it undermines public confidence. And that just plays into more people being refused access, which is illegal.
The impact of service refusal goes well beyond the immediate inconvenience. An international study conducted by Assistance Dog International found that being denied entry to a venue impacted handlers beyond the immediate practical inconveniences. In Australia, 58% of respondents to the survey said they had faced refusals over the past 12 months, with 56% experiencing multiple refusals. As a result of that refusal, 59% of Australian respondents considered avoiding public places altogether. As for Mr. Murray, he said he had met many understanding and accommodating people during his travels with Max, and he would not let the bad experience at the pub mar his impression of regional South Australia, nor would he let it dampen his desire to fight for his rights.
Yeah, we need to try to be considerate of people and realise that some of having an assistance dog, or for having a disabled parking thing, or for using a cane or something, it's just that's something that they feel, or that Jim B as well, a medical professional, feels that will assist that person. And in this case, for myself, then yeah, Max definitely assists me. I would be living far less of a life if I didn't have Max.
Arj Gannison with that story, and a spokesperson for the Department of Health, Disability and Ageing said the government was currently working on a set of national principles to improve consistency across states and territories. And finally, here on Australia Wide, we head to Victoria, where a medical charity is helping the environment and is saving lives by redistributing old medical items to those who need it. They are diverting 15,000 tonnes of medical waste from landfill while giving wildlife carers the resources to nurse injured animals back to health. Danielle Pope has this report from Tarwin Lower.
Hi, guys. Want your food?
It's feeding time at the Bass Coast Wildlife Rescue Shelter in Tarwin Lower in Victoria. Wildlife carer Sue Moore attends to the family of baby magpies who noisily demand their next meal. They are just some of the many creatures who have found themselves in Sue's care, including koalas, kangaroos, echidnas and even birds of prey.
I've had 80 koalas come in 12 months. And approximately about 350 animals come through the shelter as well.
Her latest patient is a young koala joey named Sunny, who Sue took on after finding his mother was injured in the wild.
He's a little terror. So at night time, around about 3 o'clock in the morning, he starts making these noises. So I've got to get up. I have a dressing gown, so he climbs on my dressing gown.
It's a round-the-clock job for Sue, who's been rescuing and looking after wildlife for more than 20 years.
I suppose the difficult part is full-time, getting up in the middle of the night, feeding them and all that sort of stuff. And when you have a lot of orphans that come in, you've got to keep them fed every 4 hours and all that.
Now her job has been made significantly easier through the donation of old medical equipment that would have otherwise gone to waste. A charity called the Medical Pantry has given Sue's shelter swabs, bandages and even an incubator, which would have been used to help preterm babies at Melbourne's Mercy Health.
I had a big koala that lost its temperature, so we were able to put it into the hemocrib and brought back that temperature back up. And then if I have young babies, like furless babies, I can put them in there and it keeps that temperature all temp, instead of having them on a heat pad, because if you have a heat pad, sometimes they get a bit too hot, where that one's constant temperature and it keeps them really, really warm. So even birds, you could even put birds in, because if birds have been hit by cars, they go through shock. So you need a bit of heat for them so then they don't get cold as well. So it is a good help to the shelter.
Dr. Martin Nguyen is the founder of the Medical Pantry. He says he was working as an anaesthetist 10 years ago when he realised just how much waste was produced by the medical sector.
These, the supplies that we donate are still in their packaging. They're still in a cart, in a box, in a carton. And the reason why it gets thrown away, there's multiple different reasons, but the main reason is that we have a healthcare system that is top-notch, that is on demand. So with the fact that it's on demand is that we need to stockpile. And that stockpiling results in waste.
The charity now acts as a conduit, diverting that waste away from landfill to support more than 130 partners nationally and overseas. supporting humanitarian causes and wildlife shelters like Sue's.
We sit in between donors who have too many medical supplies and then recipients who are in desperate need of medical supplies.
As well as helping those who need it, the reuse of medical equipment is also helping the environment. According to a 2018 study published in the Lancet Medical Journal, the health system is the second largest contributor to the nation's landfill, accounting for 7% of the country's greenhouse gas emissions. The charity is hoping to expand so that it can continue to do more.
So at the moment, we're only saving about 5% of what is actually going to landfill that can be redistributed, and we want to be able to do that better.
And as for Sue, she's hopeful Sunny will continue to build up his strength and eventually be released back into the wild. While it will be sad to say goodbye, she says those moments are always bittersweet.
And when you open it up and then climbing up the trees, it's a reward, really, because that's what you've done. You've saved it.
Danielle Pope reporting there. And that is Australia-wide for this week. Sinead Mangan will be back with you on Monday. I'm Alex Hyman. Have a wonderful weekend. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.